Opening the Gates of Hell.
Children believe in good and evil, they believe in right and wrong, they believe in systems of justice, and they have a natural understanding of those things. So you can get away with scaring kids in the book, you can get away with having evil characters.
That's Sean Connolly, author of the new Halloween thriller, The Gates. We'll also air an archived interview with magician Alan Kronczak, author of The Sorcerer's Companion, A Guide to the Magical World of Harry Potter. It's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's that time of year again to turn away from the really scary things like war, climate change, and economic meltdowns to the lighter side of horror. Our guest today is Irish mystery writer John Connolly. Best known for his Charlie Parker series, Connolly has also written a number of books that dip into the spookier side of fantasy fiction. One is The Book of Lost Things, about a young boy who finds the characters in his books have come to life. And Connolly's newest addition to the line is The Gates, subtitled The Gates of Hell Are About to Open. Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is what you'll hear when riding London's underground as the doors to the train cars open. Connolly jokingly calls The Gates a book about Satanism for kids, older kids, ages 12 and up. And grown-ups can enjoy it too, as I did. It reminded me of my own childhood fantasy favorites, like Edward Eger's Half Magic, Edward Ormondroyd's David and the Phoenix, and the Narnia stories of C.S. Lewis. Although The Gates is in that genre of magical adventure, it's more of a tongue-in-cheek romp through horror. It also has a smattering of fascinating facts about science and religion. The heroes are an intrepid young boy, his spunky dachshund, and a soft-hearted demon named Nerd. They're called upon to save the world from an invasion from hell. The invasion is all the fault of the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, which has opened a crack in space-time to let through a very nasty advance party sent by the Great Malevolence himself. Well, John Connolly, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, in your delicious new novel, The Gates, a somewhat precocious young boy, 11-year-old Samuel Johnson, is witness to something most peculiar that happens at 666 Crowley Road. Tell us what he sees.
Well, he sees a party of would-be Satanists, not very good Satanists, attempting to open the gates of hell. So it's a book about Satanism for kids, you know, which is good, because I think that's an area that isn't catered for enough, I think, you know, Satanism for small children. It's supposed to be quite a kind of humorous book about kind of faith and science, I think. And it came about largely because I was getting tired of magic kids in books. Like, I didn't know any magic children when I grew up. I knew kids who could steal a bicycle, but I didn't know any magic children. And I wanted something that featured a kind of regular, if eccentric, little boy. And I have two stepchildren. I have an 11-year-old and an 18-year-old. And it came out of wanting to write something that I thought would make the 11-year-old laugh a little bit. And maybe scare him a little bit, too, because I think kids like being scared in that kind of very safe situation where you're scared, and then you laugh, and then you're scared again, and then you laugh a little bit harder.
It is pretty scary. Now, and you say you have an 18-year-old and 11-year-old stepkids.
Yeah.
It struck me that this book really could cover a whole range of ages. It says 12 and up, but I think it could really be for a little bit younger kids, precocious readers, and adults as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think any author who uses the word crossover should be taken out and beaten with a stick. I think that's a very publishing marketing oriented concept. I wrote it essentially as a book that anybody over the age of 12 would like, but particularly kids. And I think the danger is publishing wants to tap into that crossover market. It loves the idea of getting a Harry Potter or a Twilight, something that sells to adults, because actually children's books, there hasn't been that big explosion in sales of children's books really that was expected. A small number of writers appeared, and we're talking somebody like J.K. Rowling, who we're never going to see again in our lifetime, I don't think, that kind of surge of enthusiasm for a single writer, and to a lesser extent, Stephanie Meyer and the Twilight books. There was a perception that children's writing could be a kind of cash cow, as long as you could pull in the adults as well. And so I read recently a an interview with a very well-known American crime writer who was asked what she was reading, and she said, oh, I'm reading young adult books in preparation for my own young adult series. And I did feel like some little part of me wanted to crawl under a rock and die, because quite clearly what was being engaged in was a kind of marketing exercise. You know, I will look and see what the little ones are reading, and I will create something that's quite similar to that because I know that it will sell. And that's not an untypical attitude. And I just find that immensely depressing. I find the idea that essentially children will be exploited in that way, and I think it is a kind of exploitation, when actually writing for children is a kind of responsibility, I think, and one that writers should take seriously. And great if you can make some money on it, I think that's absolutely fine. You know, we're all trying to feed our families and pay our mortgages. But that, I'm not sure that should be the primary motivation for writing for children.
Well, what is your primary motivation? I mean, you mostly write for adults, and here
about 8 years ago, I had the idea of this little boy, Samuel Johnson, discovering that his neighbors, and actually wasn't called Samuel Johnson at the time, discovering that his neighbors were trying to open the gates of hell. And I thought, that's a really lovely idea, and I have no idea how to go about writing it. And at that point, I was very much writing, immersed in writing my Charlie Parker books. I think I was probably on about Dark Hollow or The Killing Kind. And the idea stayed with me. And a few years ago, I wrote a book called The Book of Lost Things, which I always thought was a book about childhood for adults, a book very much about reading and how certain people see the world through books, and that then colors their lives and experiences forever after. And I think, having done that and having done a book of short stories called Nocturnes, which again tapped into fairy tales and ghost stories, I realized that was actually an area of writing I really enjoyed doing. And I could do it outside my Parker novels. And the kind of arrangement I have with my publishers really is that I do a Parker novel to contract, essentially. And then I can do anything I want outside of contract. They may not like it. You know, they may not even have to buy it. But it's a chance to experiment and do something different. And so I see, looking at my career now, that there seem to be kind of twin paths. There are the Parker novels, which I really love doing. And then there are these other odd little experiments, like The Gates or The Book of Lost Things, which kind of re-enthuse me a little bit for writing the crime series. I come back to them having felt that I've exercised a new set of muscles.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Irish mystery writer John Connolly about his latest work of fiction, this time for young adults, called The Gates. It's about how the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland opens up the gates of hell and what transpires thereupon. The Gates is full of humor. In fact, I laughed out loud at many points.
When I was writing The Book of Lost Things, one of the loveliest, in fact, one of the loveliest writing experiences was for me, at one point in The Book of Lost Things, David, the boy in that book, encounters the seven dwarves, who turn out to be kind of semi-homicidal and are argumentative and actually borderline socialist, communist dwarves. And it was a chance to really run riot and write something that was just purely humorous for a couple of chapters. And I found that immensely rejuvenating. I loved doing it, and I realized that I missed doing comic writing, because when I wrote for the newspaper, The Irish Times, I used to do a lot of color writing, and I really enjoyed that. And so when it came to The Gates, I thought, actually, this is a book that is going to have just an awful lot of humor in it. It is a book that's going to be funny, and it's going to pull little bits of history and odd little byways of knowledge that I'd found and that I found curious, and would find a way to incorporate them into the book. And I'd noticed that Alistair, he quite liked books that had footnotes in them. My agent, for example, thinks footnotes are anathema, you know, that they're things that put off adult readers. I think Alistair associated them with little bits of extra knowledge that he could read or not read as he chose to do so, but that didn't get in the way of reading the story.
Alistair?
Yeah, he's the my 12-year-old. And I thought, wow, you know, that's kind of interesting. Rather than putting big wadges of explication into the center of the book, I can do these kind of odd little footnotes, and I'll keep them very light and I'll keep them very funny. But it enabled me then to introduce kind of concepts that you don't always get in children's literature. Right? I don't think there are many children's books that kind of mention Thomas Aquinas, you know, or engage with, you know, Roy Kerr's theories of black holes, or try to explain quantum physics to a 12-year-old. But those little footnotes enabled me to try and do those things, to take what are actually very, very complicated concepts and put them in ways that actually a smart kid will understand.
Yeah, in fact, it was the first time I ever understood black holes was when I read your explanation, and neither did I know that Thomas Aquinas was the origin of the idea of in the
investigation. Dancing on the heads of pins.
Exactly.
Yeah. And those are just kind of curious little details that appeal to me. And I suppose come from one of the benefits of a university education, I think. Now I realize that the professor who used to teach me about Chaucer, which was how I ended up reading Aquinas at one point, sent me one of his book of essays, which were very in-depth essays on Chaucer. And I in turn sent him a copy of The Gates, which wasn't quite on the same level. But I was able to point to that footnote and say, See, all those classes I went to, one paragraph I got out of 4 years, one paragraph.
And you also bring together science and fantasy in one of those, well, and actually in the whole book, and I'm talking with John Connolly about his latest book, The Gates. It's a book for young adults, I guess they say, but it can be enjoyed by anybody. And that is a footnote about Lewis Carroll and the theory of wormholes. I had no idea that Alice in Wonderland actually in some way prefigured or was connected to this idea of wormholes.
Well, we always associate Carroll with being, you know, the writer of Alice in Wonderland, clearly being a reverend, also maybe having some peculiar notions about the degrees to which it was okay to take photos of small children. But he was also quite a brilliant mathematician. He was an extraordinarily bright man, and yeah, certainly some of those theories. He was, you know, through the Looking Glass, there are kind of references to what appeared to be would later be called wormholes. You know, he had clearly thought about this, and we have to recognize, obviously, that scientific theory isn't something that simply pops up. It's a process of development over kind of centuries, and you can see some of Carroll's work, both fiction and nonfiction, as a kind of interesting little stopping off point on that. But again, it was one of those things that I found curious. You know, the details, those little details that are thrown into the books are kind of, they're there because they contribute to the larger picture, I think, and give you a kind of different angle on what the book is discussing.
Yes, they do. And so the connection between wormholes and hell is the idea that we have multiple universes. This is an idea of modern physics, that these wormholes are passageways between one universe and the other. And of course, now we bring in the Large Hadron Collider that plays a very key role in your book, The Gates. Tell us about that and tell us what universe it actually opens up a connection to between that one and ours.
Well, Hitchcock used to talk about MacGuffins. They were the little things that powered the plot along, kind of catalysts. You know, in North by Northwest, it's that moment of mistaken identity where Cary Grant gets mistaken for somebody else. And I began reading about the Large Hadron Collider, which famously is this attempt really to recreate the moments after the Big Bang and to try and understand something about the origins of the universe. And when they began getting ready to turn it on, there were these terrible, they were like the Millennium Bug stories that we had in the newspaper. Oh, the world is going to end. They're going to create a miniature black hole and we'll all be sucked into it, or the world will be turned to dead gray matter. You know, something awful is going to happen. And something awful did happen, which was that it didn't work. You know, they turned it on and basically something went pop. And rather interestingly, I was reading in the paper yesterday that a couple of physicists have speculated that this may actually be an attempt to sabotage it from the future because we shouldn't know this kind of knowledge. So all these wonderful little theories come up when you start talking about the Large Hadron Collider. But that became the MacGuffin in the plot, essentially, that they turned on this collider, and because it went back right back to the origins of the universe, and among the origin things of the origins of the universe were the origins of evil. What later became evil was there. And it became this connecting point, and it opened a doorway. And so essentially what happens is these people who are messing about with stuff in their basement that they shouldn't be messing about in are doing it right at the point when the Large Hadron Collider happens to be turned on. And consequently, this gateway opens between essentially two dimensions or two universes. And there, as you say, there is a theory in science which talks about multiverses, which is the idea that actually there is not just one universe, there are actually many universes sitting side by side. And curiously, that was something, again, that was speculated about in the 19th century, and it's really only come around again, actually long before that, and it's actually really only come around again with quantum theory. So it is funny to see ideas that would have been speculated upon hundreds and hundreds of years ago actually finding quite an interesting scientific basis now. So that was then the way into the plot. I thought, oh, okay, that's how the book is going to work. It's going to be this collision between science and something much older and much more sinister that has been waiting in the background.
And, you know, this is an interesting point about science and superstition, it seems to me. You're making a connection here. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, there. After all, you're using magic to explicate science, but you're also saying that superstition hundreds of years ago actually prefigured science.
Well, theories. People have quite interesting theories and interesting ideas, and then science catches up. The book very deliberately begins with a quotation from a man who was a kind of contemporary of Nietzsche, a student of Nietzsche, who said that it's not scientists who are after the truth, it's the truth that's after scientists, which I thought was a lovely idea, that actually there is something waiting out there for scientists to actually catch up with it and discover it. One of the things when you begin addressing these issues, I come from a Catholic background, so, I went to church and I was an altar boy and I was all of these things, and I'm probably a bit of a lapsed Catholic now, but you do need to make the distinction between faith and science, and that's made really on the first page, that science requires proof. The nature of faith is that it shouldn't, and I get very annoyed with people who kind of... who want to teach creationism alongside the theory of evolution in schools, because actually, faith is a very different creature. Faith is something that you kind of have, by its nature, you have to take on trust. There's a lovely song by a group called the Triffids. Their lead singer died a couple of years ago, a guy named David McComb, and there's a lovely song called "The Lord Burns Every Clue." And I think that if you believe in God, you have to accept that. You have to accept that actually, the Lord has burned every clue. You're not going to get any of them. So the book very early on tries to make a distinction between faith-based belief systems and scientific systems, which are evidentiary-based. This is the only country, and I love touring in the U.S., and I have a house here, but certainly it's the only country where someone will seriously say to me, your book mentions evolution on page 2, do you think that's going to be controversial? And you kind of think, well, no, not really, this, we don't live in an Islamic state, so I presume that I'm allowed to raise these issues. And one of the nice things, one of the things I guess I'm proudest of about the book is that it throws in all kinds of ideas and assumes that children are curious. It assumes that children want to ask questions. It assumes that children want to have things explained to them so that they can then go away into a corner and think about them and come back to adults and ask more questions on the basis of them. So I love the idea that kids will ask questions about whether it's evolution or creationism or the existence of a god or, the nature of quantum physics and universes, and that their parents start tearing their hairs out because, they're getting a headache with these kids asking awkward questions.
Yes, and I think that was one of the really charming aspects of it. You really respect children. There is, as with the kind of sophistication of the humor, but not sophistication that a kid couldn't understand, rather one that appeals to a child's own sense of humor and own sense of quirky understanding with holes that they have of their world.
I also think I can remember being a kid, and kids don't sit around thinking, I'm a kid. They're like dogs. Dogs don't sit around thinking, well, I'm a dog. This is really tough. Kids are constantly struggling towards adulthood. They're constantly kind of straining towards a greater understanding of the world. They want to have their horizons broadened. As we become adults, our inclination to do that narrows slightly, and that, we figure, we have enough information. We don't want the internet to get any faster. We don't want a more complicated cell phone. We're struggling with things as they are. And I think you have to accept, you have to kind of look for the little kernel of adulthood in children. That doesn't mean that you're writing adult books for them, but you have to respect the part of them that actually is going to blossom into something else, and you have to encourage that. I had to go on the Today Show in London, which is a kind of very well-respected radio show on BBC Radio, taken care of by a man named John Humphreys, who's a very smart but quite argumentative man. And I had to justify the fact that there are moments in the Gates that are scary. And one of the things I had touched on was fairy tales. The Book of Lost Things, that book I wrote a few years ago, is very much a book about fairy stories. And one of the difficulties with fairy tales is that when the Victorians got their hands on them, they bowdlerized them, essentially. They took out all the violence and all of the threat because they believed that these stories should be just tales to charm and entertain. When you take the threat out of these stories, when you take any real potential for danger or evil out of them, they become kind of cartoons. And kids have a very well-developed sense of good and evil. adults are the ones who complicate that later on, who engage in games of moral equivalency. Children believe in good and evil, they believe in right and wrong, they believe in systems of justice, and they have a natural understanding of those things. So you can get away with scaring kids in the book, you can get away with having evil characters, as long as at the end, justice, not necessarily good, but justice triumphs, and kids get to see a just ending to it. So it's, you know, it's curious that at the end of a Baudelaireized version of Snow White, say, you know, Snow White's mother, your stepmother, as she is in the later stories, disappears off into the forest or is never seen again. And in the original story, she's put into a pair of red hot shoes and made to dance herself to death. And most kids would kind of go, you know, that's pretty fair for what you tried to do to Snow White. You know, I accept that as a form of justice. So I was quite conscious of that in the writing of the book. I can remember being my own childhood, and I can remember being irritated by books that didn't respect my own attempts to try to understand the nature of the world. So it's a kind of balancing act, and it goes back to what I said at the beginning. I think you have a responsibility when you're writing for children, but and that primary responsibility is one of it's a degree of honesty in the way that you write for them.
Honesty?
Yeah, I think you have to be more honest with children. I think you can get away with things with adults. You can obfuscate with adults. You can play kind of games with them. You can assume a level of knowledge which is actually it's next door to cynicism. I think you can assume that adults have made a certain set of assumptions about the world, and those are unlikely to be changed drastically. You can't do that with children. You can't make those assumptions.
You know, it's interesting because you have all, like a fairy tale, you have all the classic characters. You have the evil witch. You have the mean babysitter. You have the uncomprehending grown-ups. You even have a not very bright but good-hearted guy who's supposed to be a villain but isn't, and that's a Nerd, the Scourge of Five Deities.
Well, Nerd's a demon. What's kind of quirky, I suppose, about the book is that by and large, the demons that begin emerging are kind of socially inept on a whole lot of levels. They're not really the kind of people that you're going to be entrusting with trying to rule the world. You know, they're not very good at it, and they're not very bright. And Nerd is essentially a kind of child. You know, he's this poor guy, he's this guy who quite fancied ruling a little bit of the world and got banished for it and has been stuck in the middle of nowhere. And he goes into this new world and he says, my God, this is spectacular. You know, at one point he gets really excited about eating a jelly bean, you know, which he's never tasted. He thinks, this is great. And look, and you've got clouds and you've got little dogs and you've got sheep. Isn't the world really interesting? And he has that kind of childlike enthusiasm. And something then connects between him and Samuel, because Samuel has that too. You know, Samuel is physically and mentally a child. Nerd is kind of emotionally a child, but in a very, very good way. You know, he's kind of decent for a demon, I think.
And he's part of the justice solution.
Well, he is. He kind of instinctively recognizes that what's right and what's wrong, and he thinks, as Samuel does, that it's, you know, if you've been living in hell for near eternity, which is basically not a very nice place, why would you then come to a nice place and turn it into another version of hell? I mean, what would be the point in that? And the question that's kind of Samuel's ultimate logical question, and it is a very logical question. You know, why wouldn't you just stay where you are? Isn't it? This is just born out of a kind of envy for what other people have. And you kind of realize at that point that Samuel actually has a very well-developed sense of not just himself, but of how the world should work. He's not an innocent, really, in those terms. He actually has a very quite sophisticated, yet ultimately childlike understanding of the world and how it should work.
You know, I wanted to ask you, what you mentioned your book, The Book of Lost Things, and now I'm so intrigued by it, I'm going to go out and get that one. That's about the influences that people have as readers when they're children. Your book, your latest book here, The Gates, made me think about the books that so impressed me when I was a child. What did you read when you were a kid?
The first book I read was an Enid Blyton Secret Seven book, and I can remember sitting on the table in our living room struggling to phonetically pronounce words. For years, I thought the word cupboard was pronounced cupboard, because that was how I pronounced it, you know, as a child when you begin breaking down words into their component forms. But then, having gone through a spate of reading everything in the junior library up until about the age of 8 or 9, one of the curious things about young adult fiction is that it didn't really exist when I was growing up. I'm 41 now. There was no young adult fiction. What happened was eventually you exhausted everything in the kind of 8 to 10-year-old section or 8 to 11, and you went to the adult library desk and said, would you mind giving me an adult ticket here now, because there's nothing I want to read in here. And I very quickly progressed on to, I think the first adult book I borrowed was H.G. Wells, which was probably at about the age of 8 or 9. I very quickly moved on to Ian Fleming's James Bond books and Alistair MacLean novels. And I think that was quite a typical progress for a boy of my age at that time. There was quite a big jump from reading children's fiction into reading adult fiction, some of which might not have been entirely appropriate, but didn't create any major difficulties. Certainly no public library in Dublin in the 1970s was likely to be stocking porn on its top shelves or anything. So there was nothing that was going to be terribly, terribly difficult or troubling. But when I was riding the gates, I was very conscious of that, that actually I didn't struggle with reading adult books at the age of 11 or 12. I was a very well-developed reader. That doesn't mean that the gates is filled with, you know, there's no swearing, nobody has sex. There are no adult concepts in that sense. But I was able to read adult writing, you know, writing that had been crafted and aimed at a readership that was older than me, because I was a smart reader. And I think kids who begin reading at an early age, we forget how quickly they develop as readers and how able they are to grasp books that we might think of, oh, you know, the prose in that's going to be quite difficult for you. In fact, generally it isn't for children. Some of the concepts might be, but actually the prose itself they don't struggle with.
In fact, I was listening to an interview yesterday with a very well-known teacher in Los Angeles who has been teaching his fifth grade classes Shakespeare, and the interviewer asked him, you know, wasn't this language too difficult for children? And he said, well, actually not. You know, it might be difficult read, but I have them listen to Shakespeare plays and they get the language right away. Or Huck Finn, that's the other book that he has them read. These are all books that are taught in high school in this country now, whereas, you know, children are quite capable of reading them.
Absolutely, and we have tended towards a lowest common denominator in the books that we give our children and the way that we educate them. You know, if we go back even 50 or 60 years, I think our children, those children who have an education, were probably certainly better educated. You know, they were being handed quite difficult things. They were being made to read Latin. You know, it would have been a matter of course that before you went into secondary school, you had some knowledge of Shakespeare. It probably would have been required before you went in. And increasingly what we do is we infantilize our children. We do it in part because the government may want to massage grades. You know, it may want to make it seem like people are better skilled than they are. You know, the No Child Left Behind program is essentially a form of infantilizing the way that we educate our children. And it's probably done in part with kind of good intentions that, yes, you know, that just because you're a bit slower doesn't mean that you shouldn't have an education. On the other hand, just because you're a bit slower doesn't mean that everybody should move at the same speed that you do. And I think we're in danger sometimes of not allowing those children who want to develop at a certain pace the ability to do that by giving them work that's challenging them, by giving them work that forces them to think a little bit harder, by giving them books that may contain concepts that actually they have to struggle a bit with. You know, quantum physics is not the easiest thing in the world to understand. Somebody once said, if you think you understand it, you haven't looked at it closely enough. So the idea that you then put it into a children's book as a matter of course may seem a bit odd initially, but children don't look at it that way. Children think, well, this is interesting. It's not easy, but it is interesting, and it's something that's worth struggling with.
You said in the beginning that each one of these books that you do that are kind of outside the mainstream of your work gives you a lesson, teaches you something that you can then bring back to the mysteries that you write. So what did this book give you?
Probably a little bit of a lightness of touch, I think. A lightness of touch, and I learned a little bit more about pacing. It's quite a fast-paced book, whereas with the Parker novels, I'll sometimes take my time a little bit. So I thought it was quite interesting to write something that moved at a much faster pace with shorter chapters. So that was interesting. I'm not sure whether what I learned from The Gates is necessarily going to be able to be applied to the Parker books. Rather, what I did with The Gates, I think, was applied some of the ways that I write for adults to how I was going to write for children, which was, like I said, not to make any assumptions that kids were going to struggle with long sentences or difficult concepts. But I did then return to the Parker book. It's going to be called The Whisperers, with a kind of lighter heart, I think, for having done this, and a sense that, yes, you know, it's like when you go to the gym, essentially. You exercise your legs one day, and then you go in the next day and you exercise your arms, because your arms haven't been challenged and tested, you know, and your legs are recovering. And I think that's a good way for writers to be. I think especially writers who work within genre tend to fall back after a period of time. Well, tend to fall back on a kind of comfort zone. You know you can do this. You know you can write the same book over and over, essentially. And your readers will go in and buy it because they have a loyalty to you, but more particularly they have a loyalty to the character that you write about. And it's very easy to make that assumption and to take those readers for granted. And by doing these other things, I guess I keep myself on my toes a little bit. And the result is that each of the books in the series, the Parker series, tend to be quite different because they come from me returning from a very different place each time.
Hmm. Well, this was a terrific read, The Gates. It's all about the gates of hell being opened. But there was even a point, as a matter of fact, where I was afraid that it would not end well. And then I said, oh, no, this is a children's book. It will end well.
Children's books always end relatively well. And I think, like I said, I think that's a kind of duty ultimately towards children. It should reinforce some good notions about the world. The world is, things don't always end well in the world, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't always end well in the world.
Hear, hear. Well, John Connolly, thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca. Thank you.
John Connolly is also the author of the Charlie Parker mystery series, including Every Dead Thing and Dark Hollow. Next up, Alan Kronczak talks about The Sorcerer's Companion. Stay tuned.